Hello, my name is Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado Denver. Today I'm talking with Dr. Candace Shelby, Professor of Philosophy at CU Denver, about how she is thinking about the pandemic using the tools and methods of philosophy.
Thanks so much for talking with me today, Candace.
It's my pleasure.
Would you tell us first just a little bit about how you got into philosophy?
Sure. I actually fell into a logic class and had no idea what it was, but I really, really liked it. And I really liked the professor, so I took another one. And that was fantastic. And so let me just tell you, back up a little bit. I had changed my major in college 5 times because I'm broadly interested. And every time I did, I felt like I got stuck. But then after those 2 logic classes, he suggested, why don't you take another kind of philosophy class? And I tried a couple and thought, oh, I could study everything. I could do history and literature and politics and ethics and science. And so I decided philosophy was a thing for me.
Wow. So your gateway to philosophy was logic.
I know that's not the usual way in, but
I loved it too. When I took it, I was surprised. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I loved literature. And so I thought, oh, logic's going to be something that's going to be hard for me, but I loved it too. No, that's interesting. And so now your work focuses more on addiction, but that's not where you started.
No, actually I started in the history of philosophy. I took an undergraduate degree that was kind of like the undergraduate degree that we have at CU Denver, in that it guaranteed a broad background in the history of philosophy, and then some choices for specialization. And when I got to grad school, I just kept doing the history of philosophy because it felt familiar, and I really liked the complexity of Leibniz in particular. And so I worked on Leibniz all the way through tenure, the first 7 years of my work at CU Denver. And then I was looking for something new. I'd always been promised in grad school, once you get tenure, you can do anything you want. And I got a sabbatical. And that meant that I had 1 semester to figure out what I wanted to do next. And so I started reading on neuroscience and biology and genetics. And then I know exactly the reason. My mother had died of drug addiction to prescription drugs. My father had died of a heart attack after 50 years of smoking cigarettes and being unable to stop it with all the technologies and approaches that doctors offered him. And my sister died of what they called cardiac arrest, but kind of in the rock star cardiac arrest thing, which mm-hmm. is your heart does stop when you have an overdose of drugs or lack thereof. So what I had been reading over and over and over for my whole life, I was concerned with this issue, was that people need to go to treatment programs. And the treatment programs, almost all, maybe 95%, had basically zero medical care and 100% 12-step based treatment, which meant that people were supposed to evaluate their character and look at their moral flaws and their resentments in order to overcome addiction. So, but then they said it's a disease, and that just seemed a paradox to me. I kept trying to think, how can we both be saying disease and that the treatment is just put somebody together with other people like them and tell them to look at their character? So I spent that whole semester investigating various approaches to addiction in particular. And then I think I wrote, the first 100 pages of my book or something on that sabbatical. And I learned a lot of things about addiction and about our economy and our culture, about the way that humans interact with one another and about othering, a number of things, that just a constellation of issues around human well-being and our inconsistency in the way that we treat it. So there's the addiction impetus. There's the impetus for studying addiction in particular.
Yeah, and this is because of this work that you've been doing. I wanted to ask you about how you're thinking about addiction and maybe substance use more generally during this time when people are isolated, don't have access to 12-step meetings, don't have access to maybe the treatments that they were receiving before. And in particular, the thing I was thinking about is it looked like for a minute in Colorado, the liquor stores and dispensaries, the cannabis dispensaries, were going to be closed as non-essential businesses, and people flocked to them. There are these photos, you know, of people standing in these very long lines trying to get liquor and cannabis before these stores closed. And it was later, I mean, I think it was within 2 hours, they were left open as essential businesses. But I was wondering what your take on that that flocking was, that impetus that people had to go and stock up. There are obvious answers, I know, but I was wondering for you as somebody who's studied this so carefully and from the motivations that for why you're studying it, how you saw that phenomenon.
Okay, well, let me back up just a little. I use the word addiction all the time when I was researching my book, and at the end of the day, when I was asked to give a Mile High TED talk about it, I ended up saying, I don't think addiction's a thing. And evidently, some psychologists, psychiatrists agreed, because the DSM-5 finally switched to the term substance use disorders. And so we're talking specifically here about substances, but there are other kinds of disorders, and that's how I think of these situations. They are syndromes, and they are something has become disordered. Priorities get confused, and certain neural pathways also get confused, and certain habitual behaviors get inculcated. And I really like to think about those disorders as, because they're disorders. They're not people types. And disorders can be reordered. So in respect to your question, I think everybody probably has a pretty good idea of why people flock to the stores to stock up on these particular substances while they still had the chance. That's to be contrasted. That's because, first of all, the vast majority of intractable substance use disorders have underlying issues of anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And if you look further, you see that the way that we've created our particular culture, we have skyrocketing cases of anxiety and depression in the general population. But what we didn't have was closing of pharmacies and restriction of Xanax and Valium and Librium and Prozac and all the things that people take to cope. Within a couple of hours, I don't think that the reason that those stores were designated as essential businesses was because they realized that anxiety and depression and coping with a situation that's unprecedented was just unusually cruel, and closing down this group but not the prescription meds group. I think the reason was that nobody wanted to see riots and chaos. But then, of course, we saw this sort of moralizing, this judging of the people who were in those lines. And I actually took a drive around the block. I'm only about four blocks from Colfax, and looked to see what they were talking about. And there was huge crowds at these businesses. But what nobody, I mean, so there is this, well, these people are, they're so close to each other. They're breathing on each other. They're being morally responsible. What's the matter with them? And I think that we have to realize that in order to make a cool-headed moral judgment about what you ought to do, you have to be in a condition where you're not cognitively overloaded. But if you're cognitively overloaded because of panic, because of anxiety that your life is going to go out of control, then you can't make those decisions. Morality doesn't come into that. And of course, if you think about the alcohol establishments in particular, you can realize that some of these people actually do have their lives on the line right in those moments, because alcohol withdrawal can result in death within hours. So people trying to manage their lives, trying to cope with something that they perceive, and rightly so, that it's just it's too huge for them to even contemplate that moral issue. And I will say something else about that too, that we didn't, and I haven't seen anybody moralizing in this case, for example, about letting people out of jails and prisons. I've even seen that the Attorney General has been trying to facilitate release of prisoners from the federal prisons. Why? Well, because it's just too cruel. That's beyond anything the American judicial system ever wanted to do, even for those who are retributive-minded. It's just too cruel to leave people in places where they are sitting ducks for something that can kill them. So it's not a question of justice. Oh, this one gets out, but that one doesn't. This is everything that we're doing right now is based on triage thinking. And of course, people are going to approach, they're going to panic and run into any place that they can, where they think they can get some coping tools. Surely, you know what would happen if they had told us for even 2 hours that all the phone services, not the internet, but Verizon and T-Mobile, all of those required special licenses, and you would have to get them today, because tomorrow we're going to turn off all the phone services during this lockdown. You would see lines of people climbing over each other in ways that the alcohol and the dispensaries didn't even begin to foreshadow. And I think that we need to understand what happens in the situation when people are using substances as a coping tool. And so I think maybe if we think about it more like that, more like that than anything else. But there's another example I wanted to raise just briefly, and that was there was no moralizing in the case of the Costco 60 plus early shopping hours, which I also visited it was Tuesday. So I usually shop once a month and stock up on all the things. And I saw the elderly and the people with the oxygen tanks and their walkers, and they were around the Costco, out the back, around the back of the door, around back of barricades that they had set up, all the way through the parking lot. And they hadn't distributed baskets or anything yet. So these people were also right on top of each other. And I wouldn't get out of the car. But I understood, because everybody is trying to find ways to cope. And those people in that line were afraid of young people being faster, mowing them down, breathing on them in the stores, and were trying to do what they felt that they needed to do to take care of themselves. And I think all of these cases are similarly motivated, and they're all understandable.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting in the case, well, in all three cases that you mentioned, the sort of lack of larger systems of support that do leave people on their own. And I was thinking, you know, I know a lot about prisons and jails and detention centers, and the part of what's happening, I agree with, you know, getting people out of these institutions, but I think it's really worrisome the kinds of situations they're getting thrown into.
Absolutely.
The kind of lack of support for people who are now being suddenly turned out without the basic things they need to survive in this situation. And that but it strikes me like that's what's happening in the case of elderly folks and of people who need substances, as you said, to quell anxiety, to address depression, or for other reasons. Just the kind of lack of other support systems or ways of addressing what's going on are kind of profound in each of those cases.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think this is one of the things that philosophers are going to be thinking about for a long time. And I would, I really, really hope that it raises a public discussion, because the inequity issues here and our lack of willingness so far as a society to provide stability, sense of self-control, basic services for everybody has been highlighted in the brightest, brightest shades by this epidemic.
And it sounds like for you as a philosopher, you can, in, for instance, the kind of moralizing of the rushing to the dispensary, you were able to change that, reframe that situation to see the dynamics at play there, but then also begin to look at other cases and look for parallels and analogies. And how does that maybe broaden the scope of your analysis or make you think in terms of something like moral imagination, right? It seems like what you did there was you connected it to these other phenomena and looked for the interrelations, and that let you think differently about what was happening.
Exactly. This is one of the things that I've been telling my class as we've been transitioning to online, well, to remote teaching and Zoom classes, that we are all in a fearsome, tragic, alarming situation. But what we have as a bonus as philosophers is we have a tool set for being able to generalize, universalize, compare cases, do thought experiments, and understand things in a different framework, as you said, and which allows us to see apparently unlike cases in a similar light. And I think that it makes it easier for me to think about what's happening in all different kinds of families and different kinds of situations and environments. And it helps me to be less inclined to do the sort of I'm different cognitive bias that we all we naturally have. And the other one that I've seen that's prevalent in us is what Dan Ariely he's a behavioral economist, has said, as we see people do little cheats. They do the little ones that minor excusable, and it's just another sort of example of cognitive bias and othering. But people say, oh, I'll just let my child play with one neighbor family child, or I'll just go to the store and get the baking powder even just this one time. And my little cheats don't count, but everybody else's can be, if I don't identify with those people, those can be judged harshly. Mm. What philosophers have at our disposal is this ability, that's what we do, to step back and look with cooler minds at other situations that could be compared and to see what is a more even-handed way of understanding what's happening.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing how you've been thinking about substance use disorders and just substance use more generally during this, world historical extraordinary time. I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate your taking the time to do this for us and for our students, Sarah.
Oh, my pleasure.